If you enjoy today's interview, please subscribe, rate and review. It helps others find me. I'm Shalina Tobin, aka Posh Nosh Girl. My guest today trained under the likes of Gary Rhodes, Gordon Ramsay and Marcus Waring. He's a regular on our TV screens. He's chair of judges for National Chef of the Year, and he's won GQ's Best Chef 2018. He's considered one of the greatest chefs in Britain in his own right. It is, of course, the lovely Paul Ainsworth. Paul and his wife Emma have transformed the quaint seaside town of Padstow into one of the best culinary venues in the region, starting with Michelin-starred Paul Ainsworth at number 6. Paul, it's so lovely to be speaking with you again.
It's lovely to be speaking with you, and thanks for having me. And thank you for an amazing introduction. Wow, that was very, very kind. Thank you.
Oh, well, it's all true. And Paul, the last time we spoke was through the first lockdown, where I think we covered everything about your career history. And if anyone hasn't heard it, you can find it on my podcast. It's a fantastic interview. It really gives good insight into Paul's journey of becoming the successful chef and restaurateur that he is today. And Paul, before we get into the interview, congratulations on retaining your Michelin star for 2021. It's been 8 years running now.
That's right. Yeah. Amazing. You know, amazing news. As always, you know, a really proud moment. And also as well, you know, it's the Michelin star's fantastic, but I'm also very proud of the Mariners and Cafe Reggiano and Padstow Townhouse, all listed in the guide. You know, that's no mean feat. You're not listed in the guide just because you've got a venue. You have to be, you know, good enough to, you know, to be recognised and listed in the Michelin guide. So, yeah, super proud of all the teams. And, you know, winning a Michelin star is one thing, but retaining it is another. And I think sometimes people forget that. It's almost like it's valid for 1 year. It's not like once you've got it, you've got this badge of honour for the rest of your life. It's then retaining it. So that's, you know, in some ways more difficult. Keeping that consistency and those high standards all the time. So, yeah, you know, all down to a brilliant team.
Yeah. And as you said before, you know, you're as good as your last meal. So, you know, you've got those standards up, which is, you know,
very true.
Yeah. So, Paul, third lockdown now. How have you been since the last time that we spoke? It was just after your birthday, May last year.
Yes, it was. Yeah, I mean, I got to say, this one's probably the most difficult. Certainly, you know, for me, speaking personally, you know, there's all sorts of factors, isn't there, that play into it. The weather isn't the same as, lockdown one. It's you know, it's very kind of grey and, you know, and bleak. I think we're going to be locked down in hospitality for a very long period. I'm looking end of April, early May. Anything before that to me is just going to be a bonus. So, you know, it's third time round, and it's so hard. It's so exhausting starting and stopping, and so much goes into it. And I'm not just talking about hospitality, any sector, any business, to keep your teams, you know, healthy, both physically and mentally, to, you know, to look after them, to reassure them, to make sure that the reserves and the cash flow, you know, is maintained, you know, throughout the whole of this lockdown to when you open. Because whilst furlough takes care of one thing, furlough doesn't take care of all of the other outgoings in the business. So it is a huge strain. It is very, very, you know, very, very difficult. But as always, we remain hugely optimistic. We're, you know, we have a very strong business. We have no redundancies throughout the whole of this. We have no plans to make any redundancies. And that is down to, you know, the last 15 years for me of building something very, very strong on firm foundations with great people that's allowed us to, you know, to, like I say, when times like this happen, you know, that we have got those, you know, we have got that backup. And like I say, those good cash reserves to look after everybody and look after the businesses and not close anything. But it's not without its strains.
Yeah, of course. You mentioned, you know, talking about the mental health of your staff. How do you do that? How do you help them with their mental health issues, if they have any?
Just completely staying in contact. And, you know, I've always tried to, like, you know, exercise, and it's normally always been pretty much running. And, you know, and I know we're going to, you know, get onto this, but I am by no means cracked it and got the formula, you know, right. I've certainly in the last few years of my life, I feel that, like, I've got no time for me. And a lot of the time it's kind of actually, am I running these businesses or are these businesses running me? Mm. And the time then for me is just non-existent. But when you do get given time like this, and this is the positive about it for lockdown, you know, there's nothing we can do. We can't challenge anything. We're shut down. So it's what you do with that time. And I know that when I've got the time, there's nothing that makes me more mentally sound than just getting out. And it doesn't have to be like a hard workout. It doesn't have to be a 10-mile run. It can be a short run. It can even be a big, long walk. But just being outdoors, getting those endorphins going, and just that kind of happy feeling it gives you when you've done like a nice long walk, or when, you know, you come back off of a run. And more recently, I've bought myself a bicycle, so I'm now road cycling.
Awesome.
So that's what I really try to encourage into all the team is, you know, let's look at this from this point of view. We're not in London. We are in one of the most beautiful parts of the world. We all live here. And this is when, you know, times like this, when Cornwall just absolutely comes into its own. And I mean, the whole team are just out. You look at their Instagrams and what they're up to, and just the walks that they're going on. And I mean, it's the places you discover that you didn't, you know, that you've never been to. And it's absolutely phenomenal. So that and just constant communication, Shanina, you know, we have Zooms with different departments, different teams every day. We are constantly working on new ideas. And I would definitely say, for me, lockdown, if you look at the positives, we have grown so much from lockdown one. We have looked at it and, like, when did we ever imagine in our lifetime that we would get this amount of time? And the type of person I am and the type of leader that I try to be to all of the team is that, like, let's look at what we've got and let's polish it even more. Let's refine it even more. Let's look at it, question everything. And what can we do with this time? And they are all, you know, just so up for that. So that keeps us busy mentally. You know, when it's safe to do so, it allows us to develop things from a physical sense. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it's just fast forwarded, you know, what we do. It's allowed us to have that helicopter view for such a long period of time on what we're doing, and it's made us stronger. And that's how I get through this. It's how I get through anything, by just keeping myself extremely busy, having this amazing amount of time that we all hope that this is the last lockdown, the final lockdown. We'll never have this time again. And for me, I use it wisely from a personal sense, eating better, having more meals through the day, you know, smaller portions, but more, allowing my metabolism to get back to where, you know, back to normal, instead of just leaving the house very early and having a diet of, you know, coffee and stuff like that. Yeah, my own personal well-being, but also, you know, from the businesses, just looking at everything and all those things that sometimes we don't quite get the time to do, we're doing now. And it's fun and it's brilliant. And yeah, it is a bit like, you know, when you're sort of kind of like having, you know, like a really nice dream, and then you wake up and it's like, oh, actually, that wasn't real. That's what this is a bit like. It's sometimes you think, oh, it's all good, but then that worrying, sickening feeling comes over you of, like, you know, especially when we thought we might be back end of February.
Yeah.
Even if we missed February half term, we thought we might be back. But then a couple of weeks ago, we were starting to hear May as a date, and now I feel that is very real. So when days like that happen, you don't just digest that. It does make you really, really kind of think, right, okay. And, you know, and then when you work out what it's costing to be closed, it's astronomical. You know, it's astronomical what it costs to be closed. So that's just a general overview. But I always deal with everything, you know, glass half full, be positive, because I've always said to my team, you know, if I've got a headache, they're going to have a migraine. And that's the way, you know, the way I lead, no matter how I might be feeling, no matter what happens behind closed doors, you know, when I'm chatting, with Emma, and I've got to come out. We're going to get through this super positive. And that's the best way I lead. You can't show that negativity or that worry, because if you do, the everyone around you will crumble.
Yeah, there must be a lot of pressure for you around that. You know, you've got to keep your morale up to keep everyone else's morale up. I know you mentioned you go for walks and you're out and you're exercising and you've changed the way you eat. But, you know, on moments where you do feel like you're going, you feel down, how do you lift yourself up in that moment?
Yeah, I think sort of certainly since I did MasterChef, when we were the American Embassy, and that episode went like quite viral. It was almost like it was refreshing to sort of see a smiley chef and positive. And it seemed that chefs were just sort of shouty, sort of sweary people and that. But, you know, people would be mistaken if they don't think that I'm like, you know, I don't get down. Or, and like, I'll tell you now, there's many a time when I leave home and I'm driving along and I know that the minute I get into Padstow or the minute I get into Rock, I have to put this hat on. I have to walk into the space or the environment that I'm going into. And I've got to shake it off. I can't go in there because otherwise it spreads. And if you are that type of person who's the captain, you just can't be like that because it will spread onto your team. And that is very, very difficult. And there's lots of, I always say, I hate that saying, you know, behind every, you know, successful man, there's a, you know, a great, not at all. It's not behind. It's the very minimum is by your side. But for me, it's, you know, Emma's what people, and with, you know, with people I respect, like Tom Kerridge and Beth, you know, and people like Gordon and Tana and lots of kind of great couples that I look at in my industry, you know, Sat and Amanda, it's your partner, male or female, that, you know, like someone like I know, like Claire Smith, you know, with Grant, you know, it's that partner that's actually paving the way and clearing the path and keeping you sane. And when I come home and unload, and sometimes I come home and I bring quite often work into home life and I can't help it because I'm just consumed by it. And sometimes I don't know which fire to put out first, which problem to sort of deal with and sort. And that's all the things that people don't see. And what, you know, there's lots of factors that I'll drag myself out of it, but the main one always is Emma, that is there, that's that voice of reason, that it's that, like, come on, it's not as bad as what you think. This is how we're going to solve it. This is how we, you know, we deal with it. And I dust myself off and I get back out there again. And
amazing.
That's how I deal with it. But anyone would be seriously mistaken if they think that the sort of personality that they see in me and just like I'm happy and smiley, you know, and stuff. I'm like that because yes, I naturally am that kind of person. It's how I was brought up. I think that personality comes out in the way I cook, in the food philosophy, and the things that I like. But I also know that in order for me to be successful and for my businesses to be successful, that is down to the quality of the people that are within them. And if the person that they're looking to make the decisions to sort of, like I say, captain the ship and you know, take it on the right journey. If that's some miserable, angry, you know, when that person's got a problem, they don't speak to their team for a few days, or they sulk, or anything like that. For me, you're just going to have a very, very unhappy brigade, ship, workforce. And it's just not a nice environment to be around. I spend more time with these people than I do my own family. And it's got to be an upbeat, energetic environment that's like, we're doing it together.
Yeah.
We're in this together. Like, you know, I'm not a megalomaniac, you know, like quite often, Shalina, I actually haven't got the best idea. I might not have or if I have got the idea or the vision, or I'm the fire starter, but I might not act. I'm quite often not the best person to actually make it a reality. You've got incredible craftsmen within the business that then make it a reality. Yeah. And that's then what makes your business, certainly the business I'm in, all about the people. And if it's all about the people, then it has to be a good, strong, happy environment. Sometimes it's very hard when you're feeling down, or you don't feel yourself, or you're in a dark space, to go in. But that's a strength in me, that no matter what, I will go in to the office, to the kitchen, to the property that I'm going to, or whatever I'm doing. And you've just got to like grab it from down here, dig as deep as you can, and yeah, be like, right, okay, deep breath, leave those problems at the front door, and in you go.
Yeah. And also, you know, really good energy is contagious. You talk so, it's so lovely to hear about your team and, you know, how much time you spend with them and the energy that you all share. So I guess on days where you do feel really down, they will actually fill you with good energy. And then, you know, it kind of bounces off each other as well. So it's really good to have that.
So true. And you yeah, absolutely, what you're saying there is so, so true. When you, like I say, when you build, you know, a great team of people, and you know, and I know it's one of your questions further on, but you know, I've had some really reflective moments over the last year, and when you remember what it was like 15 years ago when you first started, and you look at your team, like, you know, your group executive chef, your COO, your accounts, HR, guest relations, you know, my EA, Carol, and these are all amazing, you know, and I'm talking here that, you know, like the administration team and stuff. And then you've got the brilliant team on the ground, you know, all your head chefs, all your sous chefs, your front of house team managers. And you look at these brilliant people that are just absolutely brilliant, and they inspire you so much. Their energy gives you energy, and also as well, it gives you a competitive nature, because you always want to be seen, or I certainly do, as that, like, I don't become irrelevant, that I don't become that, like, they don't need me anymore, or I'm actually not that relevant in my business. I always want them to feel that I can give them a different perspective. I can give them a different idea on what they're possibly thinking, and I can help them, you know, get to where it is they want to get to, or what idea they want to bring, or anything that they're kind of thinking, I can be a big part of that. And when you've got brilliant people within your corporation, within your, you know, your group, that makes you, it ups your game. Mm. It ups your game, because you're like, these are seriously talented people, and you want to remain, like, you know, you want to remain that, like, you are totally relevant, and that they can come to you. And that's with anything, whether it's business, whether it's the financial side of things, whether I'm having a conversation, you know, with Alex, who's our COO, and we're really deep diving into the profit and loss accounts, or we're talking about really sort of, you know, complex financial information, or whether I'm walking into Number Six or the Mariners or Cafe Reggiano, and that want to bring that fire of creativity and helping build dishes and coming up with new ideas. Mm-hmm. So my role isn't, I can't just focus just purely and solely on the food. I've got to focus on everything, but I've got to remain an expert in everything, not just being a chef that is just, you know, sole focus on the food. Not when you want to, or certainly what I've wanted to do, and that is build this sort of small collection of businesses that, you know, that just ultimately aren't designed by a concept. They're just designed by that if we are associated with it, if it's got our name, then it stands for great quality. And, you know, and that's, you know, the thing that drives me to be the best I can be for them, because they inspire me. And if you don't have that hunger, if you don't stay relevant, if you don't keep reading, if you don't keep researching, if you don't stay up to date, quite quickly you become left behind. And then all of a sudden they kind of, oh yeah, the old man's a bit, he's old hat, he doesn't know. This is where things are at now. This is where we're, you know, where we're doing. So that keeps me well on my toes.
Yeah, really, really inspiring. It's been such a roller coaster, particularly for those in hospitality, for your industry. And I know you said earlier on that this has probably been the toughest moment that you've been through, but I know that another really, really difficult moment was when the announcement came of the first closure and nothing around furlough had been announced. I can't imagine the fear that, you know, that you were going through, potentially, you know, losing staff, the business. Talk us through your emotions at that time and, you know, what you were going through.
Yeah, it was a Monday. I was at, we have an academy, the Paul Ainsworth Academy, which is basically for any age group to get into hospitality. And it is basically an old fashioned apprenticeship, which we fund. And, you know, something sort of really proud of. And that particular day, I'd taken all of the management down there and we were doing workshops. And we all knew what was going on. We all knew that, you know, that coronavirus was just really kind of gaining pace, and it was just in the news every day. Yeah. And I received a text message. I received a text message from Derek, who's a big part of, you know, what we do within our businesses. And he said, had I seen the news? So I went outside, got on my phone, and seen that Boris had announced that for everybody to stop going to pubs, clubs, bars, restaurants. But there was no infrastructure for pubs, clubs, bars and restaurants on what was going to happen. So immediately, the first thing I remember doing, I actually called Jill Stein from Rick Stein's, and, you know, said, look, you know, Jill, what's your plans? Because you started to see now that restaurants and, or certainly people in my sector, were closing. Mm-hmm. But it's not as easy as that for when you've got multiple businesses. And at that point, we had over 140 people employed. You've got people like John Walton, Chris McClurg, Alex Tozer, Paul Dodds, to name a few that have been with me over 10 years. John Walton being with me pretty much since day one. You're hearing about redundancies in certain restaurants, and it was horrible. I didn't know what to do, because no one knew what to do. And when I was speaking to sort of Jill, they had, they had taken an actual insurance that like covered that. And at the time, I think we thought that like, okay, well, our insurance will help us. And then quite quickly we learned that it wouldn't. And I think a lot of people learned that their insurance didn't cover something like a pandemic. That was a separate insurance. So we didn't have that. And up until the announcement of furlough, I was quite lost. I didn't, you just didn't know where to turn. And because it was so new, I could see like quite a lot of people in my team, almost no matter what people said to you outside of that, yeah, but Paul, it's not your fault. It's a pandemic. It's not Paul Ainsworth's restaurants are going bust. but you can't help but sort of almost take some responsibility for it when you are in it. Yeah. Because you've got certain staff that you know that look, well, because they're reading online, you know, on Instagram that, you know, that wherever their friends work, their restaurant's closed down, you know, but they might be a small independent. It's not an easy decision to make when you've got, you know, 140 people to look after. Yeah. And I've always looked at that as well as, you know, you've got to times that number by at least three. A lot of these people within our group are sole income earners. So the effect that has on their families.
Yeah.
So whilst there was trade there and our trade was really depleting very fast, but we still had trade. So you have to stand in a very lonely place and be like, yes, you know there's a pandemic, you know there's this disease that's spreading, but whilst the trade's there, you know, we have to try and take as much money as we can, because ultimately there's only one thing that matters, and that is protecting the people. You know, everything else, you can talk to the banks, you can look at, you know, bills, you can talk to your utility, you know, people, all of those things, I can deal with that. But the thought of actually looking at people and staring them in the eye and looking at, you know, people that have been with me a long time and potentially thinking that, is this where this is going to go now? Am I going to potentially close some businesses forever? Am I going to say goodbye to people that I've kind of been with for a long, long time? So, you know, there's not many, you know, I can name one other time, but that was a very, very, very dark moment, you know, in mine and, you know, mine and Emma's life. You know, it was horrible. And I have to say, when, you know, Rishi, you know, did his kind of, you know, announcement, which was a Friday, that really did. Yeah, it did lighten the load. It doesn't solve everything. You know, you still have, you know, we still had, you know, all of our capital repayments frozen on our loans, but we still had to pay the interest on them. You know, we still had so many outgoings, but with no income. And obviously we needed the bounce back loans and all of those types of things to get through it. But, you know, we did get through it and we're here now. And like I say, we didn't make anyone redundant.
Amazing. That is absolutely amazing. And I think when we spoke, did you say it was Rajano and Mariners that weren't eligible for furlough?
Yeah. No, they were for furlough. That was the rateable value. You remember the rateable value grants? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, they were, everyone within the group has been eligible for furlough. Where furlough, I think, needs looking at a little bit is people that haven't been in the company for that long. And on this recent one, we've got people within the businesses right now that me and Emma are paying directly from the business. You know, these are top line managers. You know, our townhouse director, you know, had just joined us. You know, absolutely huge part of what we do. But she didn't qualify for furlough because she'd not been with us from the 31st of October. So you've got two choices. You either say, I'm sorry, you know, go and see your previous employer and see if they can put you on furlough. Or what we did is like, no, we're going to look after you.
Yeah, amazing. And we did touch on the debt as well. So I think you said that, you know, you had, it would take you 2 years to, and this is back in May, mind you. So in May, you said 2 years to clear the debt over just those few months that you had to just tide yourself over. I can't imagine what it would be now. How are you coping with that side of business, with the debt side?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing as well, which, you know, I need to mention is that in December 2019, you know, so I think in December it had just been announced that it was in China, wasn't it?
Yeah.
COVID, December 2019. Well, in December 2019, you know, me and Emma made the biggest decision in our life. We bought the freehold of Cafe Regano's. We bought the business and the freehold. Yeah. So you can imagine, can't you? 3 months later, we're like, oh my God, like we've just got this, you know, huge amount of debt, huge kind of loan. So yeah, that was, you know, it was extremely worrying. To answer your, you know, to answer your question, listen, we, you know, we've always got debt, and we've now got added debt, you know, like with what's happened. But what we've seen from lockdown one, July 4th came and everybody was allowed to start going out again and socializing. Cornwall came into its own because people wanted to get out. They were not going abroad. International travel was not in a very good place at all. And Cornwall just became, you know, I mean, Cornwall's a busy place, as we know.
Yeah, we tried to come. We couldn't get a table or a room.
No.
For months.
So Cornwall's, you know, and what we've always struggled with in Cornwall is it's always the same. It's all or nothing. You know, we don't have a consistent business throughout the year. We have to take it in these pockets when it's there. And that is very, very challenging to do. Mm. But what's happening at the minute is that it's given us more, it's given everybody in Cornwall who's running businesses or who's employed, it's given them a consistency. And, you know, like, I'm very grateful for that. You know, we're very lucky down here from a health point of view. From an economic point of view, that, you know, we've got huge amounts of tourism that's coming into Cornwall, that's giving everybody, you know, that's giving everybody longevity in jobs, giving people hours, giving, you know, keeping businesses who we need it. You know, I was chatting to an operator in Padstow, you know, the other day, and was like, you know, yeah, what keeps him going is knowing that when we do reopen, we're going to be very busy. And I'm the same. Do we need it?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I guess that is a positive that, you know, you can look at. And I know we're not out of the woods yet, but looking back on that time in particular, just trying to take more positives from there. You got through it. I mean, we're still going through it, but you got through it. You still got your business. You still got your team. You know, can you see the light at the end of the tunnel? Do you feel more positive about the future?
Absolutely. And even if I don't, I believe that there's, you know, after darkness comes light. And that is just my belief. I believe that this is the final lockdown. I believe that we're obviously in a very good place in the United Kingdom from, with vaccinations. I absolutely believe, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, and, you know, we're in a very good place in Cornwall. We know that the trade is going to be there, and we need it. And I look at last year, I would not be able to get through this moment right now if it hadn't been for what happened in Cornwall last summer. The trading, people were spending money. People weren't afraid to spend money. We saw it in somewhere like Number Six, like the spend per head had risen. People were buying more expensive bottles of wine. Mariners and Cafe Reggiano were just literally chocker, like morning till night. And we needed that, you know, that, Shalina, because if we hadn't have had that, there's no way I could have survived off of coming out of, well, in winter. Mm. Going into lockdown, missing Easter, missing Whitsun, the half terms, some of the summer holidays. We had to have that window we had right up until November. And it was a short window, if you think about it, July to November.
Yeah.
But in that window, we traded really, really well. And that's why we're in a position now that we can say, okay, if this is going to go till May, this is going to, you know, go till that, then we're in a good place to weather that storm. But it has to, you know, those things have to happen. Otherwise, we won't survive. We'll fall by the wayside, you know. So yeah, from that point of view, and I know a lot of people in Cornwall know that once we are allowed to trade again, then trade will be good, and we'll be ready for it, and we are going to be so much stronger. We're even more polished and literally waiting for it. You know, everybody within our businesses is just longing and looking forward to that day that we open those doors and we're in a great place. Everything is is polished, neat, smart, tidy, thought about. And we've just had the most, you know, brilliant, almost like dress rehearsal to kind of say, right, we're ready for you. Bring it on.
You really have so much resilience and such a strong drive to keep going. And I know you've mentioned before that your father was the one who really instilled an incredible work ethic in you from a very young age. Do you think this is where your strength to keep going comes from?
100%. Like, sometimes I don't know whether people were like, really, or don't believe me in that. And, you know, like Emma knows, and like my sister Michelle and stuff. But yeah, I you know, at the time when I was very, very young, of course, you just want to be out playing with your mates. But it wasn't like that for me. It was from my dad just had a desire to make me understand. The minute my brain could compute that if you want something, you have to understand how much it costs, and you have to understand that you can't just have it. Now, back then, it's a pair of Nike Air Max trainers, or, you know, a new clothes or whatever it is you want, or toys, you know, and stuff like that. It's understanding that if you want something, it doesn't just come to you. You've got to work for it. And I also look back, he was always positive, always. He saw the good in everything. You know, he just did. And that's obviously then gone into me. And yeah, you know, like when mates would call for you and it'd be like, no, you know, Paul's got to like sweep up, and I've got to like mow the lawns. And my dad had various properties, and you know, the main business was a bed and breakfast. And then around that, he had properties that he would then rent out as bedsits. And, you know, I was, from a very early age, you know, I would be like dropped off with the lawnmower, the strimmer, the rake, the brush. You know, I can even remember my mum saying, you know, like, Dave, you know, he's so young, you know, like, let him go out and play with his friends and stuff. And it wasn't. And then I got like a bit, and then as I got older, I got a bit more shrewder. And then I would start to kind of go, well, look, if you help me, I'll be out quicker. And then, you know, and I trade like cans of Coke and stuff like that to my mates to help me get out quicker. And then once I sort of got older and I wanted to, you know, I was never brought up with this romantic sort of chef story of a grandma that, you know, used to cook. And, you know, I'd you know, run home from school and like there would be the, you know, all of these ingredients. I don't have that. What I grew up in a very, you know, working class family. I had a mum and dad that, you know, that cooked. And I think that what that's the difference for me. I didn't have a mum and dad that loved eating out in nice restaurants. I had a mum and dad that cooked. And certainly to have a dad that cooked was very rare. And I only realized that when I then started to go around my mates' houses, and dads didn't cook. They didn't have a clue how to cook. Mums did the cooking. But having a mum from the Seychelles, that mum cooked for the guests at the weekend. So she would do like Creole inspired dishes, you know, curries and stuff like that. And Monday to Friday, dad would be cooking for the contractors. So we, you know, the business pretty much survived on contractors. And in Southampton, and then at the weekends it would be more family based, and it would be traditional things like roasts, shepherd's pie, meat and potato pies, you know, things like that. But he cooked. And, you know, and if it hadn't been for the career path that then I then chosen, my mum and dad wouldn't have ever have taken me or my sister to a Michelin star restaurant, because it just wasn't their thing. They didn't look at food in that way. But I suppose unknowingly, they actually were looking at food in a very good way, because whilst we didn't go to fancy restaurants, we ate well. You know, we never takeaway was once in a blue moon, and it was like a treat, and it would generally be, say, something like Kentucky Fried Chicken. And it'd be like, you know, once every 3 months, we'd be like, oh, you know, like dad's got a family feast. you know, from Kentucky. And we just kind of had home cooked meals and sat around the table.
And we're really good trainers as well, by the sounds of it.
yeah, and more really good trainers. But you know, that work ethic. And my mum, you know, not just always, you know, to give the credit to my dad. You know, my mum obviously came from also a very, very strict like upbringing. You know, really, really sort of strict. And you know, that kind of was then sort of like poured into me. And there's, you know, certain things that, you know, you take from it. I think then when you have your own kids, you don't just do everything your mum and dad showed. You think, well, okay, I'm going to sort of do it my way. And, you know, I don't necessarily think I'll do everything the same way with Cece, like my little girl and that, because, you know, by the time I was 15 years old, Shalina, I was gone. I was not even living at home. I was living in a little staff accommodation cottage at a country house hotel. Then I moved to London. And, you know, sometimes I do look back and think, you know, it was just this work. When I was at college, when everyone finished college, I didn't almost enjoy that kind of part of my life where you just kind of having a laugh at college and going over to the pub like afterwards. As soon as I was finished, I was to a hotel called Star Hotel, and I was doing, you know, and I was then working, washing up like KPing, and I'd finish there at like 11 o'clock. And then like I was just on breakfast 7 days a week. You know, it was because it was hourly paid and I just wanted the shifts. So the chef like put me on breakfast. So like as soon as I finished breakfast, every single day I was late for college. Like I was always late. And I'd get there, and I always remember the lecturer was called John Liu. And he I don't think he liked me that much, because he thought that I was just late because I couldn't be asked to get out of bed. But I was late because I was doing breakfast. And I would just stand there and take it in front of the whole classroom. You know, your problem, Ainsworth. You know, if you can be 10 minutes late, why can't you be 10 minutes early? And I'd be like, yes, Mr. Flew. Yeah, I'm sorry. Because it was frowned upon to be working. It was, you shouldn't have been working. But I always wanted nice things. You know, so as soon as I was 16, I had like a Honda MT5, you know, motocross motorbike. You know, as soon as I was 17, you know, I got my first car was a Vauxhall Nova 1.3 SR with all the gear on it, all stereo system, all of that in it. Because I liked that mentality of working hard. And I just love that sweet tasting feeling of working hard and then buying things and getting things. And it was just something, and I suppose I still am like that. I don't look at it as materialistic. I look at it as just, you know,
a reason
to get up. A reason to get up, you know, to have ambition, to want to be the best you can be. You've got one life, and to just be the best you can be.
Yeah, you are incredibly ambitious. And I know you've told me before, another very difficult time in your life, which is extremely personal. So thank you so much for opening up about this. But it's a time about when you lost your father. So, I mean, when you feel ready, could you just talk us through, you know, that time, that period of your life?
Yeah, sure. I suppose it ultimately boils down to never really having like real close up experiences with death. And I remember my granddad died when I was five. I remember, you know, my granddad and my dad being very, very close. And I remember my granddad being such a man's man. And I do remember him, and I apparently I adored him. You know, I'd be in the garage with him and literally by his leg, you know, and stuff. And You know, and then like my gran, I was, you know, I was a blue-eyed boy. You know, she was, you know, she absolutely doted on me. And I got so many amazing memories of me and my gran going over to the Isle of Wight together and, you know, going to Black Gang Chine and stuff like that. And I sort of lost my gran when I was about 17 years old. And I remember kind of being okay, like I dealt with it. And I just, because I had so much going on in my life, I just moved to London. I just started working for, you know, for Gary Rhodes. I was at that point in my life as well where I was kind of going out with my friends, and it just seemed like I dealt with it. It was a loss, but I dealt with it. And then that was it, really, you know. And I suppose where I had such a strong bond and such a good relationship with me, you know, with my dad, you know, like my dad was, you know, was my best man at my wedding, you know, that's kind of, and where I, as I got older, I realized like what a good job, you know, he'd done with me. And, you know, and it's just the basics, you know, because when you're in business and you meet all walks of life and you have the people that make it within your businesses and want to grow with you. And then you have the people that don't want to grow with you and think what you do is rubbish, you know, and you look at a lot of people and you think, it makes you feel very lucky that you had like a good upbringing. Yeah. And that you were taught the difference between right and wrong and respect and good manners and, you know, just please and thank yous and how to address people and how to get on in life, how to kind of like certain situations to be in and what hat to wear and so that you can just get on in life. And I suppose, you know, like being taught the like a really strong one, Shalene, and that is to listen. Like, I would, you know, to actually genuinely listen to what someone's got to say, rather than just listening to reply, listen to actually grow and learn from what's being said to you and realize that there's always someone that's better than you, and to surround yourself with people like that to become yourself better. And when you've had this upbringing, when you've kind of had this instilled into you and what such a big character like he was within, you know, within our family. And we're not a big family. You know, it is pretty much me, my mum and my sister. My mum's side is massive. She comes from seven sisters and one brother, but all of that family is the other side of the world. My dad was an only child. So in terms of family, there's not a lot of us here. And, you know, a real blessing has been like Emma's family, which is a huge family that, you know, makes it, you know, that, certainly when that moment happened, they were phenomenal. But it was my first dealing with cancer, like up close and personal. It was pancreatic cancer. There is no nice cancer, of course there's not, but when you are in that world, you get a lot of, you straight away, you can say some cancers and people are like, oh, okay. But when you say the word pancreatic cancer, it is met with like, you just see the look on people's faces when they know what it is. You see the, and there was just so many things that happened that I've never, ever, ever come close to dealing with in my life. Just things that live with me forever. Things like certainly on the final days, the look on the paramedics' faces when they took him away for the final time and we followed the ambulance blue lighting it to Trelisk Hospital. And I also remember the paramedic, he looked at me and it was just this look on his face as if to say, I'm so sorry. And like, think that they're the little things. And then when we got to the hospital and you rushed in, I've never been in that situation, you know, when, you know, just loads of machines and him being strapped to lots of stuff, and then they put this like inflatable quilt over him because his body temperature was really, really dropping. And then like he was just sort of asking me to like massage his feet, and like, and then like the nurse was asking me to pass her things from like the, you know, like the equipment she needed and that. And you're hands on. Your dad's like led there. I've got my wife who is like now 4 months pregnant with Cece. You've had the chats with the midwife about like, you know, right, guy, you know, Paul Wemmer, it's really important now. Like they're really absorbing everything that's around them. You know, they're going to pick up on your emotions. Paul, sing and talk to the tummy. And you're at that stage now. And all I can remember thinking is like, what kind of a baby are we going to, you know, we're going to have? Like my wife is with us right now in this unbelievable, like, sadness. It is just horrific. And like I say, all the beeping sounds, and, you know, like probably the closest I see is that is either on a film or, you know, an episode of Casualty, you know, like that. And it's all of those things that kind of stick out. And then you get to the point of there is nothing more we can do. We're going to give you a room. We're going to turn everything off. And, you know, you just sort of sit there and sort of, you know, you, my mum wanted like a pastor and, you know, stuff like that. And yeah, when you're in that, you know, when you kind of, you experience that, it is like, it's horrific. You know, it will live with you forever. And when people say, oh, time is a healer, it's not in something like that. What happens is you become, just each day goes by, you then learn how to deal with it. And I suppose it's that relationship that, you know, that I had with him, that there's just certain, you know, certain things, you know, all your achievements, all the things that you do, you kind of, you miss that picking up the phone or speaking and stuff like that. So yeah, it was, and then afterwards, you know, and like I say, you know, we've gone this deep, you know, the sort of the very last moment was just like, you know, it was weird. He would come in and out, you know, because to ease everything, you're so much morphine, you know, into them and stuff to kind of, you know, and they reassure you that they're not feeling sort of any pain. And then like the last moment, he literally like just bolted up. Literally projectile, like black liquid, like just came and like went everywhere, like just went like everywhere in the room. And again, you're just like, you're like, this is like literally watching the one, you know, the closest person into your life be like almost like brutally murdered. It was horrible. And then he sort of went back down. And then, you know, things at a tip of whim, you know, when they said, you know, would you like a pastor here? And my mum's a very religious lady. My mum said, yes. He just out of nowhere, his eyes shut. He was like, no, he's Annabelle. I don't want none of that. We don't need any of that, you know, because he was such like a man's man and stuff. And, you know, so you clearly know that they're still there. And with lockdown, I'm like every night I've now got the opportunity and I love it. And now I've got to a point, I don't know what I'm going to do when I return back to normal. Because as far as Cece's concerned, I am a part of Bedtime Story. And I've done every single one like in lockdown. I'm there. I'm, you know, I don't know how I'm going to break it to her when I'm back working in, you know, in the evenings. But so we do Bedtime Story, and then she loves going through like our phones, and Emma's phone is just got so many, you know, like that's where all the memories and, you know, and pictures are. And we were going through it, and there's a picture in there, and we're out pram shopping and we're taking pictures of the pram, and there's a picture of me. We don't ever talk about it in front of Cece, but like I looked at Emma, and then like once she'd gone to sleep, went downstairs, and like it just sums up exactly where I was. Like there's this picture of me, and I'm like literally I'm staring through the pram, and I remember how I felt back then, and it's just incredibly lost. And there was a moment that none of it mattered. None of the success mattered. And I can't help that. Like none of, you know, whether it, you know, the businesses are doing well, great profitability, you know, like you've achieved, you know, that, you know, things like, you know, where you live, that, you know, the car you've always wanted, the, you know, like whatever it is you're at, you know, you want, you know, nice watch, whatever. nothing mattered. There was, it was almost like something had just disappeared that was, that always gave me that drive, that always gave me, like I say, when you'd pick up the phone and go, like, Dad, you know, I remember when, you know, in 2012 was the first time that we'd actually made like a decent sort of profit. And, you know, I remember kind of being, you know, on the phone with, you know, with Derek and with our accountant. And it was, you know, and it was really, you know, it was brilliant and that, and it was fantastic. And after that, the next call was always him. Because my dad was self-employed, and because my dad was a really successful businessman within his own right, and, you know, and what he did, it was always great to talk to him about it. And I'd ring him up and be like, Dad, I can't believe it, you know, or like, I think we're going to move, and, you know, and buy, me and Emma sort of bought our first house together, and all of those kind of things. That's the things, you know, that I miss, you know, like I'd always, and we, you know, and I shared so many of his loves, you know, we loved fishing, we loved motorbikes, you know, all of that, like, you know, most recently I've just, you know, got myself, a new motorbike, and I'll, you know, say to him, I just know he'd love it, you know, it's just all those little things, or just, he was always so good to talk to as well. Like, whether it, you know, I remember being his kid, you know, Dad, what is the Gulf War about? Like, why, what is it about? You know, ever need explain it to me, or like, if I, you know, like now I'd love to know, like, when, you know, when we were in this whole Brexit thing for like three odd years, you know, I'd love to know what his take would be on it, on what he'd think about, you know, every, you know, things like that. So it's definitely, I'm definitely a lot better. Like I'm definitely a lot better. You know, there's sometimes it comes out of nowhere, you know, you'll just be somewhere and it will just be overwhelming, you know, that he's not here. And then it's, you know, it's your wider family. I know, like my sister Michelle, you know, she's a real daddy's girl, and that's also very difficult not having him here. Sometimes I feel I can't reach her. I can't get to her. No matter, I can try to be everything that he was to her. Like, you know, she was due to get married last year, and obviously I was when we were kids, you know, there's a 7-year gap between me and Michelle, but you don't ever imagine. I never ever thought in my life that it'd actually be me that's walking her down the aisle, not, you know, like not my dad. So you've got things like that, and because she's such a daddy's girl, I know that there's such a huge gap and sort of void, and it's sometimes it's very, very, you know, it's very, very hard to feel that. I know that her partner, sort of David, finds that very hard to feel. You know, he tried to help her, and I suppose, you know, she, you know, every sort of girl daughter wants their daddy to see them get married, to see them have children, and she's done neither. And, you know, so it's not just about me, it's about how it affects my sister and trying to be that man for, you know, for her, and try, you know, trying to kind of make, you know, keep her happy and you know, and look after her. And like I always promised my dad I would. And then you have, you know, your mum, you know, my mum and dad married 39 years, my mum's still super healthy and active and all of those things, it's extremely difficult. It was the biggest loss in my life, you know. It really was. And you know, you just, I keep his memory alive. I keep his, you know, the incredible legacies left behind alive. We're not a family that never talk about it. You know, my mum will always want to talk about it. Me and Michelle always want to talk about it, and Emma and stuff. And, you know, Reese knows who she is. She knows, you know, we call him Grandpa. She, you know, she'll pick up on things and she'll talk about him and stuff. And I suppose that as well, you know, I made the decision, you know, we were going to a football match together. We were going to Old Trafford, you know, we both supported Man United, and we were in the car, and I was like, he had gone through like the sort of the almost the most full-on chemotherapy you can go through. And that brought it, that was horrific in itself, seeing that, you know, it was you know, it was really, really, like, you know, a very harsh form of chemotherapy. And he got through that, and he actually like he didn't go into remission, not even close, but for a few months he was like, dad was back, he was fantastic. So in that time we were going to Old Trafford, and I said to him, look, why don't you move to Cornwall? You know, he was so old, you know, he was so like kind of like a stickler for the way he wanted to do things. And if it hadn't been for the cancer, he would have never have like come to Cornwall. He was like, you know, you don't follow your kids, let your kids do what they do, you know, and stuff like that. But so much had changed in his life that he was like, well, if you and Emma don't mind. And I said, yeah, but, you know, like, why not? Like, you know, we've got no ties in Southampton. Why don't you and mum, you know, why don't you and mum move down here? And like, at least then with the infrastructure I have around me, we can be closer to each other and we can, you know, look after each other. But unfortunately, by the time we got round to organising all of that, he deteriorated massively. So about a month before he died, I went home. We packed up everything that they needed, like immediately needed. And I said, listen, like, we'll help you. So he moved into our house. You know, we fortunate enough to have a big enough house that, you know, that we had a downstairs ensuite bedroom. He could be looked after. The NHS in Cornwall were just phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. The fact that he'd lived in Southampton most of his life, the way that they just transferred all the records was, you know, was phenomenal. And, you know, so the idea was that we were going to have this time together, but unfortunately we never got that time together and stuff. But we would go in the bedroom, you know, so like the last week to 2 weeks, he was completely bedbound. And like, you know, you'd go in there and like Emma's tummy is like, you know, like really, you know, you can clearly see now, like she's pregnant. You know, and you just look at someone, and I think it's just those experiences and looking at someone and like, you know, how, you know, I often think like, you know, what was going through his head, like looking at his grandchild, knowing that he's never ever going to meet that person. And we know he's never ever going to meet that person, but we just weren't the type of family. I know that some families are quite upfront and they deal with it, but we just weren't the type of family that can actually speak about it. And it was only on the second to last day, I went in the bedroom and I sat with him, and you could still have a conversation with him. And I just said, Dad, like, I don't know how to say this, but we just didn't know how to speak about death. And I said, but what do you want me to do? Is there anything that you want me to do? What? And he just said to me, you know, and he just said, for, you know, he was like, your mum is stronger than what you think. He said, you know, like, you know, I know that you'll look after your sister, and make sure you give enough time to your child. And that was, you know, those were those three things. And it was like, okay, yeah, all right. And we didn't speak about anything else. And, you know, and sort of, yeah, that, you know, that's it. So it was so, the enormity of the situation was, you know, overwhelming. And I've often believed that, you know, people have these things to deal with, and you've just got to deal with them, and you've got to show strength. And it goes back to what you said earlier. I've always been of the, there's sometimes I think, did I process it in the right way? But I just done what I normally do. And I just buried myself in work. And that's what got me through. I knew that the unbelievable people around me, the Alexes, the John Waltons, the Chris McClurgs and the Paul Dodds and the amazing people around me at that time, you know, would, you know, just getting straight back into it. And going back to what I said to you earlier, I can't go back in grieving. I can't go back in with sadness. I've got to go back in that, like, yeah, this has happened. Thank you, lads. But don't look at me with pity. Don't tiptoe around me. We've got a job to do. And that is to be the best we can be and blow our customers away. And that was how I think that's how I, you know, so much of it I got over with was just, I've always been of the kind of the sort of sound mind that so many people look at work as a negative. It's because they've got a job that they don't want to do. And they just see work as like, you know, a way to earn money, and they live for their weekends or they live for their days off. But I know that I'm doing something that I love, that is very, very hard work, and it is a lot of graft, but I'm doing something I love, and I've always found that it sets me free, that work sets me free. And so many people complain about having to work, but actually, like, you know, work can be such a positive in your life and can really help in it. And when I've had those dark moments in my life like that, to have that reason, to have that thing to get up for, and that responsibility of my team, that like I can't be a sad case. I can't be walking around feeling sorry for myself and grieving and all of that. I've got to deal with this. It's happened. I've got to deal with it. And I know as well that like that's what he would tell me to do. He wouldn't want me to be kind of like that, you know, because fortunately he did see some of the good things that, you know, that had happened and, you know, and stuff. And yeah, you just got to dust yourself off. But yeah, there was a huge part of my life there, Shalina, where I was incredibly lost, is the best way I can describe it. Lost.
Yeah. You know, there's really no formula for grief. I'm so sorry for your loss, not only for that, but also for the trauma around the way that you lost him. I do completely empathize and understand, having been through a very similar time with my dad, who went through a lot of pain before he passed away. And actually, I feel like I've just had a therapy session with you, because everything that you've said has just struck a chord, from, you know, massaging his feet in the hospital bed to him not being there to walk me down the aisle when I got married. But what you said earlier is so spot on. You don't really get over it. I think you just, you know, you put one foot in front of the other and learn how to live without them. And having work or something to focus your mind on is so important for mental health, because grief is, well, my experience with grief, it's really emotionally, and I found quite physically draining.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And like I say, when I looked at that photo the other night with Cece, and I just look at that and it makes me feel sick to my stomach, that like I suppose to anyone out there, if one person, you know, or like yourself, finds that what I said, you know, like helpful, that like it does get better. You know, I look at that picture, and if you had said to me then, you know, like I just everything, like my eyes, that just everything about me, my skin, I look awful. I look lost. I look completely and utterly like there's just almost like, yeah, there's nothing there. And it, when you see pictures like that, it does take you back to what you were, or certainly how I was feeling then, and how I was, you know, and just how I was behaving. And yeah, you've just got to stay focused on the, you know, on the positives, you know, like, you know, if you can. And like I say, I did, you know, work was a big part for me, huge part for me, to know that like I've got to be strong for these people. You know, I'm still the captain. I'm still the person that they look up to make the right decisions. And like, I've got to be the best I can be for them. Yeah, it might be fake. It might be, you might be putting on a face, putting on a show in that, but it does come right. Does it disappear? No, it doesn't. You probably, you know, talking to you then through the middle of that bit, there's no matter what you, it just comes, that emotion, it just overcomes you. Yeah. But it, you know, I now look at, you know, I look at like all the positives, the things, okay, I can't go and have a pint with him at the Mariners. Of all the businesses that we've created, the Mariners is up his street to a T. That's the one that he would be like, do you know what, mate, you've cracked it here. This is the one. He would be loving the Mariners. And there's nothing I would love more than to just, if I could just have 5 minutes to have a pint with him there, but I can't. But then I just think, well, because of you know, that early work ethic, those simple things. Now there's so many other people that have that have played a massive contribution into helping me, you know, on my journey and learning from. But just those simple disciplines, those basic foundations of good manners, politeness, the difference between right and wrong, being a good person, being positive, always seeing the good in people. And they are all things that came from him, you know, from a very, very, you know, early age. And whilst I can't share, you know, the highs and the lows with him no more, you know, I know that, like, I'm very grateful that, you know, that I had that. And you become so grateful for it when you have your own children. And I look at Cece now, and she's so young, and she's so defenseless, and she's so innocent, and she's relying on me and Emma for everything. And it's mine and Emma's job to do the best job we can for her. And that's what I look back now and think, you know, I was very lucky that I had two parents that, you know, that did the best job they could. They did. There's no rule book to it. There's no guide. There's no anything. They just did what they did, and I'm so grateful for that. It hurts. Of course it does. But I feel as, like I say, as time, you know, as time goes on, and you know, and then you, once you sort of shake it off a bit, you know, you've got everything to live for, you know, in, you know, and like for us, it was like, you know, one life went and one life came, you know. Cece was, dad passed in the October, Cece was born in the March, and she's everything, you know. She's and if I can be, you know, if I can be half the father to her that he was to me, then I'll know that I'm doing something right.
The legacy of your father lives within you. And I mean, if you look at how far you've come, what you've built for yourself over the years, the Ainsworth Collection is a phenomenal business. Talk to us about how you feel about your accomplishments now and where you are today.
Yeah, I suppose it's lately, in the last year, we've over 15 years, we've just built something so slowly, and I wouldn't change a thing. Mm. When everything comes too quick, it's generally, it's built on quicksand. When it takes time, and it takes years and years and years, it feels right. And most recently, we took over a space in Padstow and created what we call the Ainsworth Collection, which is where the offices are now. So within that office, Shalina, we have guest relations, which is a 6-person team. Then, you know, we have, so you've got, like, you know, four desks all on an island, double screens, you know, like wireless headsets and all of this. Then we've got a hot desk, which is where Carol, sort of my EA works, you know, to have an assistant, you know, and someone like, but I've got that, I've had that in the last year, you know. I'm 41 years old, you know. I've been to various catering award ceremonies and seen people, you know, and seen chefs who are like mid-20s with an entourage, publicists, PR, PAs, all sorts and stuff. And you're like, wow, you know, fair play. But quite often I find that type of thing is short-lived. It's too much too soon. And then you've got Alex, who then, you know, became our COO. John Walton is now our group executive chef. We've got HR and accounts, a digital media, like the digital media side of the business. And we haven't opened any more businesses. We've still got the five. You've still got Paso Townhouse, Mahe, Number Six, Mariners and Cafe Reggiano. But what it's done, it's then given us this incredible, it's given us this incredible infrastructure. And then we built in there a, like, basically a, like, boardroom, meeting room. And it's all really nice. It's got nothing officey about it. It's Emma's done all the decor. She's taken a bit of all of our businesses and put it in there. So it's just this beautiful environment to go into. And it's taken all of our meetings out of the restaurants and put them into this place. And then how my journey started was with the most inspirational, incredible mentor, like, in, you know, in my life, who taught me about business and who's shown me the other side to, like, you know, that cooking is the default setting, you know, that in order to make it work, you've got to understand how the office works and you've got to understand how to be a businessman as well as, you know, a brilliant chef. And, you know, recently we then, like, Derek, who introduced me to Padstow, we've then now made our chairman, who then, with all of his experience from all of the various companies that he boards and all of the his knowledge of then taking it, you know, taking our infrastructure to the next level, looking at our staff accommodation and taking things like that, deep diving so far into what we do, so that, yes, we first and foremost, what's it about? It's about cooking the best food you can cook and giving people the most amazing experience from a front of house point of view. And that is first and foremost is everything. But then once you then have built that and you're doing that, like I say, as a default mode every day, it's then like, if mum and dad are dropping off their son or daughter, are we proud that when they drop them off to their staff accommodation bedroom? How, yes, I know every single one of my team. We, like I said to you earlier, you know, we've got over 140 people, you know, on furlough. I can walk into any establishment and I know all their names and I'll always engage and have a great conversation with them and all of that, back in before when we could shake everyone's hand, you know, peck on the cheek, or, you know, all of that. But it's like, it's going further than that. Appraisals, but like away days and the infrastructure of what we do, the simple things of, you know, fire marshals, fire training and all of that. Yeah, we've got all of that, but how good is it? How effective is it? And whilst this has been going on, you know, there's times when, like, everyone's gone out the office and I'm stood in this space and we've put like, you know, things, you know, when we've been front cover of a magazine or real moments like winning Great British Menu and being stood there with, like, you know, Tom and the winners of Great British Menu, the day we won the Michelin star, when me and Emma became ambassadors for Cornwall Air Ambulance, just real amazing moments in our life. You know, we've got them in frames and we've got our, you know, the illustrator we use and all the businesses are there. And I stand there and I look at it and think, 15 years ago, I drove down to Padstow. I went there in the summer to have a look around because the opportunity was to become head chef of Number Six. You know, the family that I was going to work for were already going to buy Number Six, you know, for their son. But then we formed this team because I'd opened a restaurant in Kent and that's how we met. And I drove a white Skoda van, like, down, because one of the tasks I had was getting a van so we could, there's no refuse in Padstow. And all my gear, you know, I had nothing. I didn't have you know, a chest of drawers or a bed or anything like that. So everything was in black bags. It was just pretty much clothes. And I drove down on November the 1st, December the 10th, we opened up to the public. And we would go nights, Shalina, like we would go sometimes like 3 or 4 days and we didn't do a cover. No one knew of us. No one knew who we were. the advice that I hung on to then and I hang on to now was there. It was like, listen, Rick Stein is the man. He has created this wonderful collection of businesses there, but people don't want to eat with Rick every single night of their holiday. You're the second night, you're the third night venue. And that was that. And no one knew who we were. No one, I had no name or anything. We had no form. We had no budget for advertising or anything like that. The bit of budget that we did have went on a website, and everything came by word of mouth and just by trying to cook the best food we could. And then I look back at that now, and I think that the waiting list to get into all of the establishments that Padstow Townhouse is a high 90% occupancy rate, that to get into number six is months, to try and get into the Mariners or Cafe Reggiano is incredibly difficult, because the places are in such high demand. And the other thing I look at, and I'm extremely proud of, is that all those eateries, Mahe is a chef's table where everything is done in front of you and it unfolds in front of you, and you can chat to the chef and you can have this up close personal experience. Number six is my life's work. It's everything, to the day we won a Michelin star is up there with, getting married, having Cece, the way it happened, the moment of being told, Emma literally right next to me, bursting into tears. I cannot tell you that feeling of winning your first Michelin star. But then to create a pub, then to create a Mediterranean restaurant, and now all of our guests, Shalina, all of them go to every single venue because they're so different. And I'm not saying that I'm like, but I get so excited, and I never knew what that was years ago. I never knew why, but it's simply down to I love food.
Yeah.
So I don't care if it's fish and chips. I'm not precious if it's a Plowman's or if it's a beautiful pizza or if it's a lovely bowl of pasta or if it's a beautiful piece of, turbot, with some beautiful St. Enadoc asparagus and an absolutely phenomenal sauce that we're doing at number six. The fact of the matter is that I love food, and I get absolutely the biggest thrill out of saying, do you know what? We've got a Plowman's on at the Mariners. I love a Plowman's. I always have. I can't ever go anywhere and get a Plowman's where it's beautiful cheese, beautiful pickles and ham and all of that. It's just such an overlooked thing that nobody cares about, but we do care about it, and we do care about the fish and chips and fried chicken. Or if you're at Cafe Reggiano and the constant quest to get the dough perfect and to make the best pizzas we can make and to make our own pasta and the ingredients that go into making those pasta dishes or making a brilliant burger. Or like I say, when you go into number six, we're working on a lobster dish at the moment, and the work that's going into it is just brilliant. And when you're I'm stood in number six and customers are coming to say hello, and they're like, oh, we're here tonight. Tomorrow we're at Reggiano's, and then we're going for Sunday roast at the Mariners. It's not because they just want to come to our places. It's because the offering is so different. There's so many restaurants in Cornwall. There's so many restaurants in Padstow. But they're going to all three because the offering is so different.
Yeah.
And I'm proud of that. I'm really, really proud of that our repertoire is so diverse that we have created businesses that the DNA and the blueprint all comes from number six. The way we look at a pizza is exactly the same way. Seasoning, acid, fat, umami, everything about what we do, trying to hit all those flavors, not always trying to hit all of those taste profiles, because sometimes you don't need to, but questioning the dish exactly the same way, looking at the fish and chips exactly the same way as we look at a dish at number six. And then you put the bedrooms on top of that. And yeah, I I I I certainly in the last few months have stood there and I never ever thought I was owed. I never ever looked at like, I've got to have that. That's what I want. I'm entitled to that. All I've ever done is taking it day by day, worked hard, surrounded myself with people who inspire me so much, like Derek, Tom Kerridge, Sat Baines, Gordon. You know, like, it's been brilliant with Gordon getting a house, you know, in Cornwall. I've really kind of caught up with, you know, with Gordon over the last kind of like couple of years, and certainly sort of, you know, in the last year. And that's been amazing because I used to be a commis chef at Royal Hospital Road, and now like I sort of can stand there and have a conversation with Gordon about business, and he's still so inspiring like he was back then, but it's in a different way, and he's also very supportive, and all of those names I just mentioned, you know, Derek, Tom, Gordon, Sat, you know, people like that I have in my life, and you know, and many more, I regard them as up here. I put them up there, and I'm a big believer in surrounding yourself with people like that, because you never, ever stop learning, never, ever stop listening, you know, never, you know, I mean, sometimes I'm, you know, me and Tom are so close, and there's sometimes where I might be in a conversation with Tom and it might feel like he's like either telling me or he's, but like, I don't ever take, oh, hang on a second. I'm Paul Ainsworth. Like I know what I'm doing, because there's, you can always learn. Yeah, and you can always, and sometimes it's the finest margin. It's like Formula One. The difference between the car at the back and the car at the front is what, a second? So like the margins are so fine. And I suppose I just have this curious nature. I'm just so curious of what's behind there. What happens if I look in there? Is there anything that could add something minute or something bigger to what we do? And that just is drives me. I'm so hungry to kind of like, can I learn off that person? Can I be inspired by like what they're doing? And I'm lucky as well, because Emma's exactly the same. She's exactly the same. She finds that in like Beth, in Tana, in Beth's sister Eve. You know, I know that these are people that like she takes such inspirations from, you know, from in how they handle things, in interior design, in, you know, all of that. It's not for everybody. You know, some people are quite proud. Some people are, you know, but if I can learn from someone, if I think that somebody is doing something better than me, I have no shame in kind of going, show me, let me learn. How can I be better? So yeah, it's mad. It's mad. I never, ever take it for granted. I never, ever think, well, yeah, I should have this. No, I shouldn't. I just, at the same time, I don't ever think it's luck, because I'm a great believer in life that you make your own luck, that you, and it's about being, when I say make your own luck, it's about knowing how to handle certain situations, how to get on in life, and work with people and not clash all the time and not kind of make things difficult and stuff, and just work with it. And so much of what happened is just by getting on. When I first got into sort of television, Tom had done Great British Menu the year before me. It was my first ever television thing. And Tom said three things to me: don't do an ice cream, right?
Okay.
Keep an eye on time. But the most important thing, treat the crew, the film crew, with the utmost respect. Because remember, it's a television show. It's not, in the grand scheme of things, yes, you are a main part of the show because you're a chef. But you are way down here. Like, don't walk in there that I'm the chef and no, I'll speak to you and I'll give you your VT or I'll give you your interview when my sauce is finished. And that stuck with me. And when I was in it, I would see chefs that like they would get so uptight and so frustrated with like, just leave me alone. Like, I'll be over in a minute, like get out my way and stuff like that. And when you, and then all of a sudden the crew are like, well, he's a bit of a tosser. Yeah. And it's that analogy. It's just getting on, you know, getting on with it. But yeah, it's phenomenal where it's gone, Shalina. It's phenomenal, like, how many people are in the group, the businesses I'm so proud of, and the positions, you know, to have people in these positions now and this management structure that make the whole thing run smooth, and it's allowed me as well to kind of like just be able to kind of look at things a bit different. I've for a long, long time, I've just been consumed by it. And I'm not out of the woods. No way. I know that when I get back into this, I'm going to have those moments where I'm going to be like, I've got no time for me. The businesses are running me. But that's a goal of mine. That's an objective of mine to get better at that. Not to just think that that's normal. Not to think that I'm proud of that. I'm not proud of that. I've got to learn how to separate things, and I've got to learn to kind of make more time for me. Because if I do that, then I'm a much better person. And if I'm a better person, then everybody around me benefits, because can give them so much more. Yeah. than if I'm not. But yeah, it's pretty mad. All of it.
Paul, you are such an inspiring individual. You, your team, Emma, I think you're all absolutely brilliant. I love what you're doing. I love your ethos. And just as a guy, you are pretty awesome. So
no, thank you very much.
Thank you for
so are you. You're great to talk to. It's very easy to talk to. You know, the questions are great, and I've really enjoyed it. You said earlier that it was like therapy, but I've never spoken about what I've just spoken about with you, and it's a two-way thing. I felt, yeah, it's kind of almost therapy for myself. So no, thank you for that.
I'm a good listener. I've been told that.
Yeah, no, you really are.
But we're not done yet. I've got one last question.
Okay.
Just when you thought you were out of the woods.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me something about yourself I couldn't possibly know.
So, when you sent this over a few weeks ago, I'd already answered this question, but it really kind of now like reaffirms it, because I was having the conversation the other day with somebody, and they were like, I never ever would have known that or even guessed that about you. But I would say my favorite genre of music is house music. Like I love you know, dance music, you know, sort of electronic music, but house, that's the one, you know. So I don't mind sort of, you know, certain, you know, bits of like techno or drum and bass or things like that. That kind of Cafe Del Mar, sunset, like kind of piano, like 90s house Ibiza of my kind of era is just, I absolutely love it. It's just got such a feel good factor. And a lot of my mates are the same, you know, that, you know, they love it. And for such a huge, huge like part of my life, I've always, and when I'm running, that's all I listen to is house. And it just literally can, you know, it will make me run faster. It will make me like, you know, like PBs and all sorts and stuff. But I will just zone out, right? And literally almost like daydream as I'm running about, like, especially to the tunes I'm listening to, about like DJing, like mixing house and playing a set to a crowd. Like, I don't never like, oh, I want to play it like Manumission or like, you know, one of the huge kind of, you know, one of the huge clubs in, you know, like in Ibiza, like just like, you know, like small setting or like just to surprise people. And again, please do not misconstrue this, but like, you know, like, I don't know if you know, but someone like Idris Elba, as we all know, like, you know, he's a bit of a don, and we all know him to be unbelievable. Like, I love Luther. Like, I think, you know, I think he would have been a phenomenal James Bond. You know, it's fantastic. But then he's got this whole other side to his life where he's like, but he's not just a DJ. He's a music producer. He makes records, makes tracks. He raps, he sings. He's just unbelievable. And it's like, I suppose it's one of those things of kind of people kind of being like, oh my God, I thought I knew he was a chef, but like he can, you know, he can sort of DJ as well. So yeah, it's definitely an ambition of mine to learn to learn how to DJ. And in my life, I would love to just, especially when things go back to normal and everybody can socialize again. Yeah, I would love to one day just be able to DJ to a crowd, and especially that type of music that just makes people feel good, and especially of our kind of age group that, you know, when, you know, some of the most iconic tunes ever were made. It's not a lot of people. Well, no one really knows that till now, apart from Emma. So to finish on that, this Christmas just gone, Christmas 2020, the best Christmas, you know, the best Christmas present of my life, like, was given to me. So Emma has bought me an apprenticeship at the London Sound Academy.
Wow.
So basically when I'm in London now, like time permitting, I can now go and like use hours and start to learn how to DJ. So who knows? Watch this space.
I had this vision of you at Mariners in the summer, like on the, you've got this outdoor bit. Kind of had this vision of you being like playing your music, DJing over there, everyone enjoying their food.
Exactly.
So that's your spot.
It is. I mean, look, you know, I would love to say to Tom Kerridge, Tom, let me, you know, if I was good enough, like, Tom, let me do a set at one of the pub in the parks. But do you know what? I have to say, like, James, you know, not last year, 2019 at Carfest, which is, again, done by the same people that do Pub in the Park, but with Chris Evans. James Martin, who is, again, you know, a very, very multi-talented, you know, individual, but he started a band called the James Martin Band, and they played two songs to about 30,000 people.
Wow.
And I looked at him and I was like, do you know what, fair play, you know, like, that's like, you know, really, really huge admiration, because it's, you know, it's just kind of having a crack and doing something and doing something a bit different. And yeah, like I say, it's just always something I've thought about for as long as I can remember. And if I'm running and there's a set of tracks come on my playlist, I'll be like, I would play it in this order, I'd mix in then, I'd start with this, I'd end with this. And I just go off into this world of being a superstar DJ.
You always give me the best stories. Last time, for anyone who hasn't heard it, Willem Dafoe's, Paul's story about Willem Dafoe, seeing him doing a number two, is absolutely brilliant. You've got to go on to my first podcast with him and have a listen. It's super brilliant.
Like, ironically, over your right shoulder is Willem Dafoe.
I know. How funny. It's meant to be. Thank you so much for spending the time with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Such personal times. Just a little reminder, if you guys want to know more about Paul's career, we cover that in great detail in my first interview with him, which you can find on my podcast or my IGTV page on Instagram at @poshnoshgal. Paul's Instagram handle is Paul Ainsworth. Just replace the letter O with a 6. And if you enjoyed today's interview, please subscribe, rate, and review, because it really helps others find me.